Thanks. Today will be the last factorization day for me, and then
Dan Bernstein, Lecture 3.
Something you didn't hear before is a scary, really terrifying proposal from the summer school organizers. It's not been made public yet, but there's a proposal that, as you know, the initial talks in each morning, it's Hugh Williams and then me, and the proposal is to have an occasional flip of me first and then Hugh Williams. And to try to avoid any chance of this happening, I'm throwing in as many references to Hugh's previous talks as possible. So, you heard this morning about continued fractions, and here's one of the great applications of continued fractions now that you know about them. Get ready for tomorrow's reference. Okay, so as you know, division is something you can do easily. You can do it by hand, and well, it's actually surprisingly fast. If you have a number with b bits, even if b is a billion or so, you can divide it by another b bit number and work out the decimal expansion or binary expansion, if you like, of that number. For instance, I divided some random numbers, 817 and 366, and came up with 2.23224044, and I could have kept going. So if you're starting from 817 and 366, you can easily do that computation. One of the wonderful things that continued fractions let you do, beyond understand quadratic fields, is you can work backwards. You can undo this computation. If you're given the digits of a number, you can figure out what the numerator and denominator were. Within limits, obviously, if you don't have enough digits, then you have no chance if the numerator and denominator are big and you're just given a few digits. But if you have enough digits, I'll be precise about that later, then you can figure out the numerator and denominator. There are lots of names for this problem of working backwards. For instance, it's lattice basis reduction in dimension 2. It's also an example of a specialized kind of lattice basis reduction called integer relation finding. It's also called a half GCD computation. Lots of names for working backwards from digits to a numerator and denominator. And while the answer to the question of can we do this computation is yes, and it's a great application of continued fractions. All you do is you expand out in exactly the way that you heard this morning in the very previous talk. You expand out. You start from the 2.23224044. You subtract off the integer part, as you heard, so you take away 2. And then you take 1 divided by that, and that gives about, I calculated, 4.3058823. And then subtract off the 4, and take 1 divided by that, you get 3 point something. Subtract off the 3, you get... and take 1 over that, get 3 point something, and keep going until suddenly, okay, at the end here, 1.400, 2.500, and finally 2.00. It's really close to an integer, so we figure at that point we're done. It looks like that 2 is 2, and it looks like the 2.5 is, well, undoing this 1 divided by 2, it's 1 divided by 2 plus 2. 2.5 is 2 plus a half, yeah, not surprising. And you can keep working backwards to the beginning and figure out that, well, it certainly seems plausible, and in this case it's true, that the numerator and denominator that we started with are what you get by working all the way backwards through the continued fraction, working out the AI and BI for A and B, A7 and B7, which you heard this morning in the previous talk, that's 817 and 366. Those are the original numbers. So yes, you can do this computation. And it's not just something doable, it's actually surprisingly fast. If you had a y-digit numerator and a y-digit denominator, imagine y being a billion or so, and you compute their quotient to 2y digits, 2y is a natural number here. If you want to recover 2y digits, then, well, it seems to make sense that you would need 2y digits to work backwards. And in fact, you can do that with continued fractions. If you have just a tiny bit more than 2y digits, then you'll be totally convinced that, yes, the numbers you had at the beginning were that numerator denominator. The time for this, if you do it with sort of naive analysis of everything going on and the A and B's that you heard about, then you easily see it's quadratic time. And you can do even better with fast arithmetic. You can get down to essentially linear time. Number of bit operations is just y to the 1 plus epsilon instead of y squared. You can also do this for polynomials. In the function field case, instead of the number field case, you can take a power series, which is the polynomial equivalent of a real number, and then work backwards from a power series to the polynomial, numerator and denominator. If you have a rational function, ratio of two polynomials, and you expand that out as a power series, like 1 plus t squared plus t cubed plus t to the fourth, hey, that sounds like 1 divided by 1 minus t, doesn't it? And that that's a computation you can do systematically with continued fractions in exactly the same way as for integers. And again, that's a fast computation. Takes, if you have y coefficients that you're working with, takes only about y to the 1 operations. All right, so that's just a prelude for coming back to factorization here, and I promise there will be a connection. This is not just throwing in references to the previous talk just to ensure that proposal not being followed. I want to tell you how fast the number field sieve is, and there's one stage of it where I haven't talked at all about the speed. I just said, well, it's polynomial time to do linear algebra. If you're given a bunch of exponent vectors and you want to find which of some subset of those exponent vectors add up to even numbers, add up to 0 modulo 2. In other words, you want to find, instead of exponent vectors, you have a bunch of numbers, you want to find a subset of those numbers whose product is a square. Important for all these algorithms that I've been mentioning and that lots of other people have been mentioning. If you want to do that computation, well, that's a linear algebra computation. And I'd like to get into exactly how we do that for the best possible speed. In general, say we have a y by y matrix. Now, actually, in the Q-sieve, it might be you have vectors of y over log y or 2y over log y in the number field sieve, that number of components. So let's just approximate that by y. And you have something like that number of vectors. So overall, a y by y matrix. If you have one extra vector, then you're guaranteed to find a linear dependency. In general, let's just say we have a y by y matrix. If you have something different sizes, just pad it out to be a square matrix. Over F2, so that means you have a matrix all of whose elements are 0 or 1. We just care about whether the exponent vectors add up to 0 mod 2, so we'll do all the arithmetic on entries of the matrix modulo 2. Of course, the matrix specifies a linear map. That's how matrices are introduced in a linear algebra course, is the matrix is just a concise way to talk about a linear map. In this case, it's I copy the 0, 1, 1, 1 into the first row here. I should comment for those of you who want to get my matrix multiplications in the right order, I'm always going to have commas referring to column vectors. So v1, comma v2, comma v3, comma v4 refers to, put on the right side here, v1, and then below it v2, then below it v3, below it v4, and similarly the commas here. That's if you take m times v being this column vector, then you get this column vector, and with that convention, I think I did the matrix multiplication the right way. All right, so this is a linear map on bits v1, v2, v3, v4, all of the additions there being modulo 2. That's what the F2 is saying. Do all the arithmetic modulo 2. Oops. All right, the basic problem in linear algebra is to find an element of the kernel of the matrix, well, preferably a non-zero element. This is what's important for the Q-sieve, the number field sieve, quadratic sieve, all the discrete log algorithms that combine congruences. If you have a combination of congruences algorithms, they find a square or whatever. Sometimes some of these algorithms don't work with squares, they work with cubes or higher powers, but they combine a bunch of vectors, modulo, exponent vectors, modulo, in this case 2, to find a square. And, well, which vectors do you have out of the vectors in that matrix? Finding a subset of the vectors that add up to 0, that's the same as finding an exponent vector, such that m times v is 0. Sorry, v is not an exponent vector, v is dual. V is, the exponent vectors are inside the matrix. If you took a vector v on the right side here, that would tell you which of the columns to add up in order to hopefully get 0. If v is, for example, 1, 1, 0, 0 down the right side of this matrix, that's saying that you take the first column plus the second column and throw away the third and fourth. If that gives you all zeros, well, that's what we want in the Q-sieve. You want some exponent vectors, column vectors of that matrix to add up to 0. And in general, finding a subset of column vectors that add up to 0 is the same as finding a V such that M times V is 0. Of course, you can trivially just write down V equals 0, but we want to find a non-zero V if one exists. For instance, the matrix I have here is invertible, so there aren't any linear dependencies. Linear dependency means a non-zero element of the kernel. It means a non-zero V such that MV is 0. But if you have another matrix, like one that shows up in the Q-sieve, then typically there will be quite a few dependencies. Once you have enough vectors, then you're guaranteed to have a dependency. A slightly broader question, although this is not exactly a generalization, I'll come back to that in a moment. Generalization is, instead of solving mv equals 0, solve mv equals w. You're given some vector w, and the problem is now to find some v, no restriction now that it be non-zero, find some v such that mv equals w. For instance, given this same matrix, well, just repeating basic linear algebra here, and given the column vector 1, 1, 0, 0, the objective is to find a column vector v1, v2, v3, v4, so that if you feed it through m, take m times that vector, exactly like before, then the first coefficient, the first coordinate is 1, and the second is 1, and the next one is 0, the next one is 0. So that's the solving linear equations problem, which does not quite generalize the finding linear dependencies problem because, well, this allows, if you have w being 0 as input, then the solving linear equations definition allows you to take v being 0, whereas for finding a linear dependency, we insist on linear dependency means a non-zero vector that is killed by the matrix. You multiply by the matrix, you get 0. But if you have a solving linear equations algorithm, which I'm going to be talking about, then you can use it to very efficiently find non-zero elements of a kernel. I'm going to talk about a couple of methods for, and one of them in detail, for solving linear equations, for working backwards from w to v, such that mv equals w. But those algorithms, if you applied them to w equals 0, you would just get v equals 0. They'll be no good for directly finding linear dependencies, because they don't guarantee that v is non-zero. However, with a tiny bit of work here, you can use those methods to find linear dependencies. You can use them to find random elements of the kernel, and, well, if there are any non-zero elements of the kernel, if there are any linear dependencies in the matrix, among the column vectors in the matrix, then you can find them. And the trick is, what I said here, you take a random vector R, and then you multiply it by the matrix M, giving you a vector W, and then you hide R from the algorithm. You give W to your linear equation solver. And I'll tell you how the linear equation solver works, and it's something that works backwards from W to V, such that MV equals W. It doesn't know what R was. This might be R. You know, looking at this linear equation setup, since you know where W came from, you could easily write down V equals R, but that's not going to be useful for us. What is going to be useful is the linear equation solver comes up with some V by whatever method, and then subtracting that from R, you get something which is in the kernel of the matrix. If you take m times this vector, you get 0. M times v minus r is mv minus mr, which is w minus w, which is 0. So v minus r is an element of the kernel, and also is random, because r is random. Among all the possible pre-images of w under this matrix m, among all the possible vectors that, when you multiply them by m, give you w, r is a random one, independent of v. So the difference, v minus r, is a random element of the kernel. If it happens to be 0, then try doing this again. If there are non-zero elements of the kernel, then after a couple tries, you'll probably find one. On average, it takes just a couple tries. Of course, if there are no linear dependencies, this will just keep going forever. You keep trying again, and you convince yourself quickly that, okay, the matrix does not actually have any linear dependencies. In light of this little trick, it's enough if you want to solve linear systems of equations, find linear dependencies, non-zero ones, it's enough to, without worrying about the zero condition, solve linear equations, and that's what I'll talk about. There's a couple of important methods, actually there's a whole spectrum of methods. I'll just tell you the one that you heard about, I believe, last week, Gauss's method. What you learn in linear algebra takes Y cubed operations. There's something like y squared elements of the matrix that you look at, and for each element of the matrix, you do y operations on some row or column that includes it. Overall, it's y squared times y cubed bit operations for Gaussian elimination. The fanciest method, what people actually use, or there's other methods which give comparable performance, but the simplest one to explain, and certainly very close to the state of the art, within a small constant factor of the state of the art, is the series denominators method, Wiedemann's method of solving linear equations, and that one takes only y squared operations instead of y cubed, assuming that there's not too many non-zero entries in the matrix. I said here, if the equations are sparse, then this method takes only y squared operations to invert m. And, well, the definition of sparse there is that you can apply the matrix to a vector. If you're given v, you can compute m times v in only about y operations. if you write down, I don't have space on the slides to write down a huge matrix that you might get, a million by million or bigger matrix from the Q-SIF or the number field SIF. But what those matrices look like is, remember, every vector in those matrices is an exponent vector for factoring some smooth number. And there's not too many non-zero exponents in a factorization. If you factor a number into primes, there can't be very many primes in it, depending how big the number is, with the usual sizes of y. Compared to the length of a vector, which is y over log y, something on that scale, on the scale of y, compared to those y bits, very few of the bits are non-zero. Because the non-zero bits in an exponent vector, if you look at 2 to the a, 3 to the b, 5 to the c, etc., then very few of a, b, c, and so on can be non-zero. So in the Q-SIF, all these combination of congruences algorithms, the matrices are in fact sparse. There's very few bits set in each exponent vector. And then this series denominators method kicks in order to invert M very efficiently. The method, as you might guess given this description of it, the method inverts M by somehow applying M a whole bunch of times. If you compare the cause here, applying M takes Y operations, and the whole solving inverting M by the series denominators method takes Y squared operations. That sounds like you're applying M Y times. And in fact, the algorithm works that way. It applies M to something like 3Y times in a clever way, which we're going to see. Here is how the method works. For a very small example, I've taken the example W equals 1100, and M is the same matrix I was looking at before, all the entries modulo 2. So if I add 1 and 1, I get 0. There is a magic equation. Just trust me on this for the moment. God says, Hugh Williams says, there is a magic equation for this matrix that W plus M cubed, W plus M to the fourth, W is 0. In fact, you know the Cayley-Hamilton theorem? Every matrix satisfies its characteristic polynomial. In this case, the characteristic polynomial of M is M to the fourth plus M cubed plus 1 equals 0. But all I care about is applying M to W, and this is the magic equation that actually matters, is that W plus M cubed, W plus M to the fourth, W is 0. If you believe me that this equation is true, and ignore for the moment how we find the equation, if you believe this equation, you immediately see how to write W as M times something. It's just move the M pieces of this magic equation to the other side, and then W is M cubed W plus M to the fourth W. That's M times something. Well, I wrote down here. It's M times, you can change the minus signs to plus signs since we're working mod 2 if you like, but okay, the minus signs I think make clear where the V comes from. If you take M times as V, that's exactly equal to W from the magic equation. Now, I said you can get this kind of magic equation from the characteristic polynomial, but computing characteristic polynomials is something really slow, and that's not what I actually did to find the magic equation here. The series denominators method is a much faster way to find the magic equation. And to explain how that works, I want to show you some of the facts that involve the magic equation. Then we'll see that one of those facts you can just work backwards and extract the magic equation from. Here's a power series. Let me ignore the algebraic fluff for a moment and just explain the example vectors, and then I'll go back to the series part of it. The first vector here is W. The second one is M times W, hopefully. Let's just check the top entry there. That's supposed to be 0, 1, 1, 1 times 1, 1, 0, 0, and I see one common bit there, which produces a 1. If there were three common bits, that would produce a 1. If there's 0, 2, or 4 common bits, that produces a 0. Okay, this column is M times W. This column is M squared times W. This is M cubed times W, etc. Ah, okay, I'm applying M to a vector repeatedly. Maybe that's where the repeated applications of M come from, taking advantage of the fact that M is sparse. All right, coming back to the algebra, we put these W and MW and M squared W and so on into a power series. At the bottom here, I've written down the usual notation for this ring that has, well, it's not a ring, actually. It's a module over a power series ring. But okay, what this notation means, F sub 2, that's the set 0, 1, with the usual arithmetic mod 2. F2 to the 4th, that's length 4 vectors over F2, these length 4 column vectors. And then bracket, bracket T, two brackets there instead of 1, means instead of polynomials in T, we're allowing power series in T. We don't insist that the series stop at a certain moment, be all zeros. at a certain moment, and in this case, it's not all zeros after a certain moment. The series keeps going forever. So F2 to the fourth bracket T means the set of, well, things that look like this. Set of power series in T, where each coefficient is a vector of length 4 over F2, a vector of length 4 whose coefficients, whose coordinates are in F2. There's the general expression for this series. I'm calling it S for a series. It's W plus MWT plus N squared W, T squared, etc. All right. This series is rational. It's a ratio of polynomials. Just like I said before, 1 plus t squared plus etc., that's 1 over 1 minus t. And that's also something you can recognize by continued fractions. Well, okay, without worrying about the continued fractions connection, this series is rational. If you multiply it by 1 plus t to the fourth, then if you actually do that computation, you can see, okay, the constant coefficient is very easy. That's just w again. And then this one is, what's the coefficient of 1 plus t in, the coefficient of t in 1 plus t times s? Well, it's just you add the t coefficient and the 1 coefficient, and hopefully that is 0, 0, 0, 1. Good. And you keep going with the multiplication, and you observe that after t to the fourth, nothing shows up. Calculate this to 100 terms, and hey, they're all 0. S times 1 plus t to the fourth, certainly on the computer, looks very much like 0. And in fact, that's easy to prove from the magic equation, that if you look at the coefficient of t to the n in this series, where n is at least 4, well, it's a coefficient of t to the n, and there's s again, times 1 plus t to the fourth. And we can just multiply this out formally. What's the coefficient of t to the n in a product? You just take every which way the product. Coefficient of t to the n in 1 times this is the coefficient of t to the n there, which is m to the nw, as I wrote down on the next line. And then the coefficient of t to the n in t times that, there's m to the n minus 1w. And then t to the fourth gives an m to the n minus 4w. Factoring out m to the n minus 4, hey, there's the magic equation again. M to the fourth w plus m cubed w plus w. It's reversed order, but okay, it's the same, same quantity that is 0. So the fact that s is rational is easily seen from the fact that the magic equation holds, that m to the fourth plus m cubed plus 1 times w is 0. And also you can see from this that the order of coefficients here, well, the m to the fourth, m cubed, and 1, that's a reversal of this 1 plus t to the fourth that showed up in the denominator of s. S times 1 plus t to the fourth is this, all the coefficients past 4 are 0. S times that denominator is a polynomial degree below 4, and that's something that, well, corresponds to in the magic equation. We had the 1 turned into the m to the fourth, and t turned into m cubed, and t to the fourth turned into m to the 0. Okay. If you want to do this computation quickly, there's one extra little trick that people throw in, which is just look at one coefficient of s, one coordinate. Just look at, say, the top or the bottom, or take a random projection so you don't have to bother writing down this huge series with so many vectors in it up to some point. You project from f2 to the fourth to f2. What this means concretely, you take some vector r, for instance 0, 0, 0, 1, and you dot r with everything. I don't have commas there. This is supposed to be a row vector r. And what happens if you multiply r times s? If you multiply 0, 0, 0, 1 times, I guess I've gotten rid of s, but all I'm going to care about in a moment is rs times 1 plus t to the fourth. R times this, if you take 0, 0, 0, 1 dot 1, 1, 0, 0, row vector 0, 0, 0, 1 times column vector 1, 1, 0, 0, you get 0. And then here you get 1 times t, and then here you get 1 times t squared, and here you get 0 times t cubed, and that's exactly the equation I wrote down here. If you dot s times 1 plus t to the fourth by r, multiply the row vector r times this matrix s, the power, let's see, this polynomial matrix s times 1 plus t to the fourth, you get t plus t squared. That's coming from the bottom coordinates, t plus t squared, in s times 1 plus t plus t to the fourth. And in general, you write down r times s is, well, it's r, what was s again, w plus mwt plus m squared wt squared, et cetera. You multiply r by each of those, and if you go back to the, maybe I should just briefly show it again. If you go back to the s expansion, then the bottom coordinates there, if you dot each of these vectors, multiply each of those vectors by the row vector r on the left, then you get 1t and no t squared, and no t to the fourth, 1t to the fifth, 1 t to the 6th, 1 t to the 7th, and hopefully that's exactly what I wrote down here. That series in a single variable t with coefficients that have just a single coordinate from F2, that series is rational. This series, Rs, is t plus t squared divided by 1 plus t plus t to the 4th. All right, in general, for any r, you don't have to take a coordinate vector like r with just a single one. You can take whatever r you want. And for any vector r, if you multiply a row vector r by s, I've written r here as a map from f2 to the 4th to f2. That's what r is doing, is it's taking a four-dimensional vector, and by multiplication, it's giving you a single bit. If you multiply r by s, you get a rational function again. You get some polynomial of degree less than 4, which depends on r. It's exactly r times the, flip back slides again, need a bigger screen. It's exactly r times the polynomial here. It's some polynomial of degree less than 4 divided by that same denominator, 1 plus t plus t to the 4th. So, the connection to continued fractions is, if you want to find the magic equation, flipped around, turns into the denominator of all these series, and you can find denominators of series by computing continued fractions. That's actually something remarkably fast. You don't have to search through all possible denominators. There's like 2 to the y possible denominators. You can just do something like y operations and figure out the denominator of the series.
So the denominator, if you choose a particular projection, you may get different denominators?
Well, you could get factors. So that's a little issue that I'll get to at the bottom here. That yes, you could get, when you compute a denominator, you could have started with, say, if you divide 1,000 by 300, but that's not in lowest terms. And continued fractions will give you something in lowest terms. The same thing might happen here. Let me come back to that issue.
Okay.
So what we do usually, well, in general, for given some y by y matrix M, second line there, and a y-dimensional vector W, the way that you find the magic equation, which is something like the characteristic polynomial of M, but we're finding it much more efficiently, is you pick some R, maybe a simple vector R like that. Often one choice of R works. You pick some R, and then you write down the same series, RW plus RMWT. So this is take M squared times W. That means apply M, it's M times W. So apply M to W, apply M to MW, that gives M squared W, then dot that with R, multiply by R. That gives you a bit, which is the coefficient of t squared. And same for all the other bits. Compute the first 2y of those bits. This is a series over F2, power series over F2, power series in t, where each coefficient is 0 or 1. And then feed that to continued fractions, and you find the denominator of this series, which in general is going to be some factor, typically a very big factor, of the denominator of the series without the r here. To account for the fact that it's not always exactly the same, we take a few r's, even a couple, you can start proving theorems about how effective this is. Say 10 r's is practically guaranteed to work. One r is not quite enough. The chance of one r failing is actually sufficiently noticeable that I feel better saying a few. Two is where you can start proving things about the success of this algorithm. If you take a few r's, and for each one you compute the denominator of that series by continued fractions, take the least common multiple of those denominators, then this is a theorem with very high probability, you will get the denominator of the same series without the R's, with vector coefficients. W is a whole big vector plus MW times T plus et cetera. Assuming that happens, and you can easily check if the algorithm fails, try it again. Assuming that happens, well, you have some denominator, p0t to the y plus p1t to the y minus 1. It's not necessarily degree y. p0 could be 0. It's some polynomial of degree at most y. By the Cayley-Hamilton theorem, at most y is going to work. And you flip that denominator around and find the magic equation. Saying you have a denominator for the original series without the r's is equivalent to saying you have the magic equation, looking at the coefficient of y. Now, from the magic equation, if you started with a w, which sometimes happens, as in my magic equation before, w plus m cubed w plus m to the fourth w is 0, if you find that p0 is 1, then it's very easy to write w equals the rest of the equation is m times something. And I've written down here, I just took the rest of the equation, dividing out an m, and this is, again, it's just like the v equals minus m squared w minus m cubed w from before. If P0 is 0, if you have the magic equation starts with m's in it already, then it's not so easy. And you have to play around with the matrix a bit in a way that I won't describe in order to solve the original linear equation. On the other hand, our interest is just in finding linear dependencies. And if P0 is 0, then, hey, we already have m times something being 0, which was the whole goal in the first place. And maybe that something itself is 0, but you can always find the first non-zero coefficient here, unless w was 0, you will have some non-zero coefficient, and then that easily gives you a linear dependency. All right, putting this together, in order to solve linear equations with the extra complication, or finding linear dependencies, which is easy in any case, overall there's how many times did we apply m? Well, we computed m times that again, for 2y terms is enough to feed to continued fractions. So that sounds like 2y applications of m plus, maybe if you don't want to save all the results, you apply m again, y times I to compute v. And that's 3y applications of m, each of which takes y or so bit operations, assuming m is sparse. And that's the advertised y squared complexity for inverted. If m is a dense matrix, it's not such a good method, but in the context of combination of congruences methods, m is always sparse, and this is an excellent method for solving linear equations. All right, putting that together with what I've said about the complexity of finding small factors of integers, I can work out pretty precisely the complexity of the number fields. Here's this formula that you've seen a few times last week and this week, that the complexity of the number field sieve, the cost measured by bit operations, is some power of this L. It's e to the something times the cube root of log n times the 2/3 root of log n. The sum power, to be precise, the best power anybody's been able to find is 1.90 something. It's not a very easy number. It's the root of some high degree algebraic equation, but well, there's some specific number which you can work out for the best exponent of this L. There are three levels of detail where you can look at formulas like this, this complexity here. You can say, all right, first of all, it's a cube root of log n. That's the most important thing here. L to the 1.9 is exponential of 1.9 cube root of log n, 2/3 power of log n. And the most important factor there is the cube root of log n, which is much better than the square root of log n for all the non-number field sieve algorithms. Actually, several papers before the number field sieve came out, several papers said, wow, we have all these algorithms that for factoring and various other problems seem to take time e to the square root of log n. And in fact, with a coefficient of 1 in front of the square root. And we conjecture that that is the best possible complexity of integer factorization and discrete logs and so on. But the number field sieve does better. It's cube root of log n, which grows more slowly than the square root of log n. And little differences in how big this cube root is versus square root, those are certainly noticeable because it's all inside an exponential. The log of the runtime is 1.9 cube root of log n, 2/3 power of log n. The second level of detail is, well, you can look at the log factors and understand why it's log to the 2/3, and that, which is a little worse than the square root of log, square root of log is only log to the 1/2. And then the next level of detail is you can look at the 1.9 and try to see exactly why it's that number. That's the best number we have. I'm going to try to address all these levels of detail. Depending on your interest, you might not care about the 1.90, et cetera, there. Actually, people very frequently oversimplify this algorithm. They make it far too simple, and then they claim that the complexity of the number field sieve is L to some much larger power because they're not really doing all the work they should do. In those cases, you'll see people say that the number field sieve takes time L to the 1.92, because those people just aren't putting in the necessary amount of work to get down to 1.90. I'll try to tell you about the 1.90, and okay, I'll say at a certain moment, you can skip this part if you don't really care about L to the 1.90 versus L to the 1.92, which is admittedly a little bit hard to care about. Even if L is really, really big, the difference of L, a factor of L to the 0.02 is kind of hard to notice. It might be a factor of 2 speed up in the overall runtime, but usually people are faced with numbers that are either way below what is hard to factor or way above what's hard to factor. We don't care about the exact cutoff. Anyway, I said this is the number field sieve with theorist parameters. It takes this amount of time. And I want to tell you what those parameters are, how you find polynomials for the number field sieve so that it gets this kind of performance. Certainly the cube root I want to explain, and then I'll also mention things about the lower, the more precise levels of detail in the runtime. First of all, the degree of your polynomials. Remember the number field sieve you could work with. The Q sieve has degree 1 polynomials. The Q adjoint square root of 14 that has a degree 2 polynomial. In general, you can have any degree D, which for current factorizations might be degree 5, degree 6. People are thinking ahead to degrees 7 and 8. It's something that grows slowly with n. It's about the cube root of log n. At the first level of detail, the degree should grow as a cube root of log n. So if you take a 512-bit number, maybe degree 5 is good. If you went all the way up to a 4096-bit number, then that would maybe double the degree D that you need. Maybe degree 10 is good. And that's a very much larger number. So the degrees grow slowly with n. Looking in more detail, well, log log n to the minus 1/3, which is very small, but it's the right correction factor in there to get the best possible degree D, to get this 2/3 working out. And then for a constant factor, which is the least important part, the degree D is normally chosen about 1.4 times cube root of log n divided by cube root of log log n. And then I threw in a plus little o of 1, saying that, well, okay, you can't exactly choose D to be 1.4 times blah, blah, blah. It's not going to be an integer. But it should converge to that for the optimization. The ratio between D and the cube roots there should converge to 1.4 as n gets bigger. For choosing polynomials, people were asking, the Q adjoint square root of 14 sieve, for example, well, how do you find a square root of 14 mod n? The answer is, for most n's, you can't. You work the other way. Is first, you find the root. M is going to be a root of a polynomial. You just pick the root, and then you write down a polynomial that kills that root modulo f. That has, you write down a polynomial f such that f of m is 0 modulo f. Or does f of m equals n? Here, what you do, you choose an integer m, which is about the dth root of n, the number you're trying to factor. And then you write n in base m. You write it as m to the d plus something, which is going to be smaller than m, times m to the d minus 1, plus et cetera, plus f1m plus f0, where each of the f's there is below m. What I've written here, I said each fk is below n to the 1 over d. Well, if m is about n to the 1 over d, then each f is going to be less than m, and that's less than n to the 1 over d. I'm allowing a little bit of slop here, 1 plus little o of 1. Maybe you allow coefficients f that are up to n to the 1 over d times log n. N to the 1 over d as a quantity, and then that whole thing times log n. And the reason for allowing a little bit of flexibility in the f's is that maybe some f's are bad. For example, I described the number field sieve as using irreducible polynomials f, and maybe the f you write down is reducible. And, well, maybe your program for the number field sieve simplifies things by assuming f has some slightly special form, like maybe f has the following roots modulo 5, or there's lots of little restrictions people put on f, and for those reasons, both for kind of technical reasons of avoiding irreducibles and things where the theory is hard, and for practical reasons of trying to simplify streamlined programs, you might want to run through a bunch of f's. In practice, the first f you try is going to be just fine for making the number field sieve work, and I'll talk more about why you'd want to vary it later. For actually coming up with a convincing conjecture, you need to say, well, okay, there might occasionally be a bad case, in which case we try another f. You might, for example, subtract m from one of the f's and add 1 to the next f. Yeah?
If f is reducible, wouldn't that give you an automatic factorization of n?
Well, yeah, as it turns out, if you factor f, then you can just plug in m into the factors, and that's lots of the cases where f might be bad, you don't actually have to worry about, because they either give you a factor of n, as you're saying. Yes, you can plug in m into the factors of f. You have to be a little bit careful there, because it turns out for d in a certain range and for n bigger than a certain function of d, if n is big enough, then you're guaranteed to have the factors evaluated at m being non-trivial factors of n. But then it might turn out if n is not big enough compared to d, in practice it's always big enough, but if it weren't, then maybe the the factors, if you evaluated them at m, you would get 1 or n. In which case, you could say, oh, there's something else you can do. You can just proceed with the factors of f. Assuming you know how to factor polynomials quickly, you figure out what the factors are, and then, oops, you don't get a serious factorization of n. There's lots of fallbacks if anything goes wrong, so I don't want to get too caught up in the technicality here. And certainly, for normal sizes of n and d, yes, if you happen to notice that f is reducible, for example, just as an example of the technicality that makes me say, allow some possible different f's, if you find that f is reducible, then yes, sure, plug in m into the factors, and you will find factors of n. But to make a plausible conjecture that deals with every n, we throw in this extra little complication, and in practice, it doesn't matter. Okay, in practice, you just, first f you try is going to be irreducible, and continue with the number fields. All right, you then write down all pairs I and j up to some bound, up to some l to the 0.95. In the Q-sieve, I had y squared numbers. And this is pretty much the y. I wrote it down here. Y is l to the 0.95, where l is that same quantity before. And you write down y squared pairs I and j, coprime pairs. You exclude the ones where the greatest common divisor is bigger than 1. And you also insist j be bigger than 0. In practice, there's lots of changes people make to try to improve things. And I'll try to give you an idea of that at the end of the talk. But for theoretical purposes, taking both I and j to be positive is just fine. You could take I to be negative, and that's an easy way to improve the algorithm. But okay, trying to give the simplest description that gives me that cube root of log n, I'll have I and j be positive integers, relatively prime, up to y, which means there's about y squared. What's the chance that a pair of numbers is relatively prime? Have we heard that already? Or do people happen to know that? Yeah, pi squared over 6. There's about the 60% chance that two numbers are relatively prime. And, well, if you start with y squared numbers, then about 60% y squared of them will be relatively prime. So there's lots of pairs, as in the Q-sieve. We've got something like y squared of these numbers. And you check for each one of them, for each pair ij, is I minus jm smooth, y smooth, where y is l to the 0.95. Okay, I wrote down here the number of pairs is about y squared, l to the 1.9. And if you look at the exponents, then you can see this 1.65. But I want to focus on the cube root of log n. How big, what's the chance that I minus jm is smooth? Well, m is big, and j is also starting to get pretty big. And I is much smaller. Don't really have to worry about it compared to jm. How big is jm compared to y? If you want to know a smoothness chance, want to know the chance that some I minus jm, some quantity is smooth with respect to y, you have to work out the u, you have to work out the ratio between logs. What is the log of this quantity you want to have being smooth versus the log of the smoothness bound? And, well, the log of j is l, not l, so the log of j is about the, let's look at l here, log of j is about the cube root of log n. What about m? How big is m? Well, m is n to the 1 over d. So the log of m is about log n divided by d. And d is about the cube root of log n. So log m is about the 2/3 power of log n, which is actually much bigger than j. The log of I minus jm gets dominated by the log of m. And most of the digits in I minus jm are in m. If you work out the log of that number, it's about log n to the 2/3 plus smaller order terms, times smaller order terms. Compared to the log of y, well, y is like l, and so the log of it is about the cube root of log n. What's the ratio between those logs? Log n to the 2/3 divided by log n to the 1/3, that's the ratio between the logs, that's u, and that's about log n to the 1/3 again, and then from that you can work out the smoothness chance, u to the minus u is something like exponential of minus u, something like exponential of minus cube root of log n, which is something on the scale of the ratio between these guys. You do the all the cube roots, and you see a 2/3 power showing up here, 1/3 power showing up there. You divide them, you get a 1/3 power, and that's on the same scale as these 1/3 showing up for L. All right, I'll come back to that balancing after continuing with the algorithm. If you work this out carefully, then you see reasonable conjectures that there's about L to the 1.65 smooth values. What's important here is that it's about exponential of cube root of log n to some constant power. all right, here's the complication. The top piece of this is the complication that I said gets from 1.92 down to 1.90. Not a big change. If you don't do that, then, well, at this point I'm going to say, along with the I minus JMs, you check is I minus J alpha smooth. To actually get the best parameters, I very briefly at the end of the first talk said, well, you can use more than a single alpha. You can have an alpha and a beta and a bunch more numbers that are all congruent to M modulo N. And if you do that, then it turns out to be a good idea for the number of alphas and betas and so on to be the 0.12 power of L. And for each one of them, you have about the 0.82 power of L as your prime bound, smaller than for the rational integers, smaller than for these I minus JMs that you want to have being smooth. To simplify this to get a 1.92, you end up equalizing the prime down here and the prime down there and reducing the number of number fields down to just a single alpha. But okay, it's not too hard to write down the general case. And if you do that, if you ask, what's the chance that I minus JM is smooth and what's the chance that I minus J alpha is smooth, then, well, you have to figure out how big I minus J alpha is. Remember, the definition of smoothness for algebraic numbers like I plus J root 14 is you figure out their norms, like I squared minus 14 J squared. You figure out the norm, and in general, this was the expression for the norm of I minus J alpha, scaled appropriately. All of those norms are something on the scale of M. If you don't worry about the constants, then basically the alpha is about as big as M. Actually, if you optimize parameters very carefully, then it turns out alpha is about 2.86 times as many digits as M. But crudely, it's on the same scale as M. So I minus J alpha has some smoothness chance, and I minus JM has some smoothness chance, and those are both about as big. They both have some small chance of being smooth, and the first one being smooth reduces the number of pairs from L to the 1.9 pairs down to L to the 1.65 that are smooth, and then you get an even smaller power of L where the I minus J alphas are also smooth. There's a bigger drop from 1.65 down to 0.95. For those of you who care about the constants, there's a bigger drop than from 1.9 down to 1.65 because actually alpha is somewhat bigger than M, and that it increases U and decreases smoothness chance. But if you're not worried about the constants, then what's important here is that the number of congruences is something like the square root of what you started with. It's some power of L. Compared to, in the exponent vectors, there's something like 2y components in the exponent vectors for multiple number fields. Well, you take all of the primes times all of the number fields is 0.95, and then all the 0.95s here. But in general, the size of the exponent vectors is something like y. That should be your intuition for how big exponent vectors are as well. You have to do factorizations. It's all the primes up to y. There's about y over log y of those. So there's enough smooth congruences, more than the number of exponent vectors, and that's the end of the analysis. We believe that the number field sieve, having enough smooth congruences, but certainly it finds a square, and we believe that that square has a good chance of factoring n. If it doesn't work, then find some more squares, and hopefully those will factor. Let me emphasize the scales of numbers here. If you want to get that cube root of log n, you have to have some separation between your degree and 1. And you have to have some separation between how big your smooth numbers like I minus JM are. Those have to be quite a lot smaller than n. The sizes of numbers, well, there's three different sizes. About cube root of log n bits, about 2/3 root of log n bits, and about 3/3 root of log n bits. There's one number which is as long as n, namely n. Everything else that runs around inside the number field sieve is a considerably smaller number than n. The next smaller numbers are m is about n to the 1 over d. And d is growing with n as the 1/3 root of log n, which reduces m down to about the 2/3 root of log n in terms of the number of bits. The log of m is about the 2/3 root of log n. I minus JM is also, okay, somewhat bigger than M, but not terribly big compared to M. And also the I minus J alphas, the integer norms of those are something on the same scale as M. I said M to the 2.86. Well, they're about the same size as M. Much smaller numbers are Y and I and J. Those are on the scale of L. I guess I should have written down L there as well. Those are much smaller. They're cube root of log N bits, not 2/3 power. For a typical n, if you imagine n being, say, a million bits, and you took these two-third and one-third power seriously, if log n is about a million, then the two-thirds power of it is about 10,000. M is going to be 10,000 digits long. And y is going to be only about 100 digits long, which is all gigantic. You can't actually do the number field sieve on today's computers for that kind of size, but you could imagine scaling it up to somewhat bigger sizes than we have now, and this is how the scaling works. I said at the bottom here that you have to get these one-thirds showing up. If you optimize the number field sieve, you have no choice but to get the one-third, because if you want the smoothness probabilities to work out, if you want a good chance of your numbers being smooth, then you always have y looking something like e to the square root of log of the numbers you want being smooth. Roughly, log y squared is log n. That's true not just for the number field sieve, but in any situation where you have numbers on the scale of m, like I minus jm, and you want them to be y smooth, then in order for that to have a reasonable chance, but not an overwhelming chance, don't choose y to be too big, then you always end up with log y squared being about log n. You can also work out the log-log factors if you like. If you want to balance I minus j alpha, balance the norm of I minus j alpha, balance the values f of I over j with m, then that means that if you look at the size of the norms, you end up with log m being about d log y, which, putting together with log y squared being about log m, forces d to be about log y also. And then d log m being about log n, well, that's just n is about m to the d. N is a value of a degree d polynomial at m, which forces n to be about m to the d. In other words, d log m is about log n, and d was about log y, log m is about the square of log y, therefore d cubed and log y cubed are both about log n. And log m is about the square of that. Putting all these together, you get log y cubed is about log n. And that's where the 3 comes from in all of the formulas. All right, conclusion from that cube root of log n is that the number field sieve is really, really fast as your numbers get big enough. For small numbers, it's not so good. Maybe around 80, 90 digits is where it's the same speed as the quadratic sieve. For a while, people were estimating that it would be maybe 300 digits of a crossover, maybe 200 digits, maybe 100 digits. And, well, it actually looks a little smaller than that. But as your numbers get bigger and bigger, certainly by the time you're factoring 5 12-bit numbers, the records have been set by the number field sieve, not by the quadratic sieve. For the current record, here's the latest number field sieve record. Factoring a 664-bit number, somebody found a couple of prime factors of that number. It was designed to be hard to factor. It had two huge random-looking prime factors, each about 332 bits long. And the number field sieve found them after a reasonable amount of computation, after 5 times 10 to the 18th cycles on some machines where they did about 2 billion cycles per second. So that's something like 10 to the 9th seconds spread across the machines, something like 30 machine years. And I think they actually used something like 100 machines, so it was some fraction of a year for finishing that computation. If you compare this power of 2, this is something like 2 to the 60 versus 2 to the 332, you're finding these primes in much less time than it would take to find them by trial division or the elliptic curve method. If you work out the asymptotics for that, you see it would have had no chance. I told you last time, the elliptic curve method has found its records are prime factors about 2 to the 200 something, using less computation, but if you scale it up to this amount of computation, the elliptic curve method still does not find prime factors of that size. As our computations get bigger and bigger, the number field sieve has been around for almost 20 years now in its simplest form, and really seriously optimized for more than 15 years. And people keep throwing in little improvements to it, but nobody's had a better idea for how we can factor numbers with the 3 changing to something smaller than 3. We're kind of stuck with the number field sieve, that all the improvements that people have put into it are not going to succeed in factoring, say, a 4,096-bit number. That's way beyond what any conceivable number field sieve variation will do. So if we're going to factor much larger numbers, then we're going to need to really have something really creative, something way beyond the number field sieve ideas that people have had so far. What I had in mind to do for the rest of the talk was tell you about some smaller optimizations if you're kind of close to the boundary of what can be factored. If you're a cryptographer and you're choosing your numbers to be as small as possible, you're choosing primes and products of primes and numbers where you're doing discrete logs to all be as small as possible because you want your arithmetic to be fast. You want your computations to fit on tiny little smart cards. You want to have as little cryptographic effort as possible, but you don't want it to be broken. So you choose your sizes to be just above what somebody can factor. Then if you have some factorization problem just barely past the edge of what we can factor now, then suddenly it becomes interesting to have the number field sieve sped up by a factor of 2, say, or 10, or 100. That could make the difference between something that seems awfully hard to do and something that actually we could do with enough computers. I forgot, oops, I have one little slide in the middle where I said, you can actually factor a bunch of numbers. Let me just skip past this, but it's a mildly interesting feature for cryptography that you can factor a bunch of numbers if you use multiple number fields with the about the same cost as factoring one number, certainly much less effort than factoring each number separately. So actually in the cryptographic context, if people give you a bunch of different RSA keys, then if they're saying, well, each of those keys is worth, say, $1 million, you can actually, if you can factor one of them for $1 million, you could probably factor 100 of them for only $10 million with the number field sieve. But okay, people try to choose their keys big enough that you can't even factor one of them. And let me go on to the little improvements of how do you try to really squeeze the last bits of performance out of the number field sieve without having any brilliant ideas for how to do much better. All right, I told you roughly how to choose polynomials, but actually you can save quite a bit of time by putting more work into polynomial selection. I said you choose some m about n to the 1 over d, and then the number field sieve seems to work. For instance, if degree is 5, then you could take any m between, say, the 6th root of m and the 5th root of n, which is a huge range. If n is big, then there's a ton of choices of m. And then expand n in base m, write it as, there might be a leading coefficient now. If m is not very close to the 5th root of n, then n could be something, I'll give an example in a moment, n could be something big times m to the 5th plus something big times m to the 4th. We'll write n in base m, and then the number field sieve looks at the smoothness of I minus jm and the smoothness of I minus j alpha. It wants this number to be smooth. I minus jm times f5 I to the 5th plus f4 I to the 4th j. These are these norms, j to the 5th times f of I over j, that the number field sieve wants to have being smooth. If you choose m in a simple way, then anything reasonable you do, take m to be as close to n to the 1 over 5 as possible, for example, that's going to work. The number field sieve will factor n. Unless, well, this was the minor technicality. Maybe somebody can come up with some n where your first choice of m fails for some silly reason. But basically, the first m you try works for every n that anybody has. And if it doesn't, just try another one. So you try m, and it works. But if you want the number field sieve to be streamlined as much as possible, want to really squeeze out the time, then you want these numbers that we're hoping are smooth to be as small as possible. Want I minus jm times the norm of I minus j alpha to be as small as possible. And we have some flexibility that helps us do that. Namely, we can choose a different m. I have an example here of the same random number n that my computer told me to try factoring. And for this number n, you could choose m to be, say, 1,000. Writing n in base 1,000 is just taking the base 10 digits and grouping them into 3s. N in base 1,000 is 314 and 159 and 265 and so on. It's 314 times 1,000 to the 5th plus et cetera. Okay, that's easy to see from N. If you run the number field sieve using I minus MJ, I minus 1,000J, how often is that smooth for various I's and J's? Well, sometimes, and for some small notion of smoothness. And write down the polynomial 314 I to the 5th plus 159 I to the 4th J plus et cetera, down to 323J to the 5th. Those are somewhat bigger numbers. Depending on how big I and J are, that can get quite big. But for a reasonable smoothness bound, you often find that being smooth also. And OK, eventually, the number field sieve succeeds in factoring n. But it's not as fast as what happens if you look at some more m's and you find a smaller polynomial. If you write n in base 1370, then instead of coefficients 300, 159, and so on, you get coefficients that are mostly below 100. 65, 130, 38, okay, there's one big one, 377, 127, and 33. That's a substantially smaller polynomial. This is a polynomial that, again, the way you get those coefficients is starting from 1370, you write n in base 1370. N is 65 times 1370 to the fifth plus 130 times 1370 to the fourth. And that base conversion, you just compute n mod m, and that's the bottom coefficient, subtract that off, divide by m, and keep going, you get the other coefficients. These polynomial values are considerably smaller than these polynomial values. So choosing a different m reduces the size of the numbers you want to have being smooth, and therefore speeds up the number field sieve. If you try it, then you find substantially faster factorization. I didn't actually optimize either of these, but even with crude choices of parameters, you see the number field sieve going quite a lot faster, finding many more smooth numbers here than it does there. If you're doing a cutting-edge factorization, then you can try not just a couple m's, you can try a huge number of m's. You might try, say, 2 to the 45 possible m's. That's a lot of m's. And then look at them really quickly and figure out the best million or so of the m's. Say, okay, we've got all these m's, and just looking at the polynomials we get from those m's, here's the million or so that seem best by some crude estimate or some really fast estimate for how good they are, which I'm about to show you. And then you look at those million or so in more detail and say, okay, here's the m that I want. This is the best m I'm going to use for factoring n. The crude estimate for how good m is here's a really easy way to estimate how good m is. If you have, all right, ignore s for the moment. Suppose I goes up to r and j goes up to r. R is the size of a rectangle here. If you have r squared values of I and j, then how big is I minus jm? Well, if j is the most r, that's most r times m. And how big is f5 out of the fifth plus, et cetera? Well, just crude plugging in how big I and j are, they're most about r, and then times how big the f's are, you easily see this bound. The numbers that you want to have being smooth are at most this very simple quantity, and now I have s showing up. If you say I'm going to have more s's and fewer j's, but still r squared of them total, if you have that many i's and j's, then here's some quantity mu. It's something you can easily figure out from your polynomial, the f's, and from your m, and the scaling factor s for how skewed your rectangle of i's and j's is. Then you can multiply mu of m times r to the 6, and that tells you how big this degree 6 polynomial in I and j can be. Based on that crude bound, you can say, well, okay, if we want to select some good m's, then one way to select good m's is by measuring them this way, by measuring how big is this mu, because that tells you how big the polynomial values can be with this overestimate for how big they are. It's certainly a way to look at some m's and say crudely that the m equals 1370 here is better than the m equals 1000. Here, there's quite a huge difference in the mu's, which is, again, this is just a less than or equal to. It doesn't tell you exactly how big the values are, but it's not ridiculously far out of the ballpark. So there's a way to look at some m's and figure out what the rough merit of an m is. Along with, you can have this s flexibility, have bigger i's and smaller j's. That's a good idea because j gets multiplied by m, while I does not. So if you make I bigger and j smaller, then that can save time. If you just try one m, if you just choose m to be, say, the sixth root of n, and work out that mu value, the measure for how good your m is, then, and just take s equals 1 for simplicity, mu of m comma 1, that's, looking at this, m times the sum of the s, if you plug in s equals 1. That mu of m comma 1 is about the 2/6 power of n. What's that coming from? Mu is the size of m, basically, times the sum of the coefficient sizes. And if m is about the sixth root of n, and you write n in base m, and the coefficients are all about the same size as m, randomly, they'll typically be about as big as m, and adding them up gives something maybe 6 times bigger than m, and so it's on the scale of n to the 1/6, multiplying that by m gives n to the 2/6. All right, question that people have addressed, and that I still have a little bit of time to show you some of the techniques that go into, is how much work do you need to do to find an m, or in general an m comma s, but even for s equals 1, if you look at a bunch of m's, how long does it take to reduce the mu values by a factor of b? Instead of having about n to the 2/6, how long does it take to find, say, a hundredth as big as n to the 2/6, to reduce your polynomial values according to this crude estimate by a factor of, say, 100? That would be b is 100. I should emphasize that the effect of finding b here, being finding an m where the b is considerably different from 1, that's as important as chopping quite a few bits out of the number that you're trying to factor. Because, well, the mu value here is about 1 over b times n to the 2 sixths. And if you can improve b, if you can improve the mu values by a factor of 100, then that's just the same effect as improving n to the 2 sixths by a factor of 100, which is improving n by a factor of a million. Or in general, however big b is, if you reduce n by a factor of b cubed, which can be quite a few bits reduced out of n, then that's the effect, that's comparable to the effect of looking for an m, somehow finding an m, which reduces the mu values by a factor of b. Depending how big b is, this can save quite a bit of runtime in the number field sieve, and when people actually use the number field sieve, they actually look quite a while for a good m, and also a good m, and that speeds up the number field sieve quite a bit. When you hear about records in the number field sieve, people are always quite impressed about getting from, say, 512 bits to 540 bits to 600 bits, and chopping 20 or 30 or 50 bits out of n is quite important in setting new records. Oh yeah, the last line there I was saying, you end up with b being rather large. If you spend a lot of time looking for m's, according to the methods I'll tell you, and then I'll finish up the talk, if you spend a lot of time looking for m's, then your b is going to be, well, however long you need to look for m's, you try to make b as big as possible. You try to make the mu's as small as possible. And if you do that, compared to a huge amount of time you might spend factoring, if you spend a comparable amount of time, 10% of that time, if you spend that looking for m's, then b is going to end up being rather big. If you look at the everything I say about how long it takes to look at a bunch of m's, then you should turn that around into, okay, how big is b? In other words, how many bits do we chop out of n? The simplest thing to do is just look at a bunch of m's, and instead of having them be around n to the 1/6, have them be somewhat bigger than n to the 1/6. If b is, say, 10 to the 8th, then b to the 0.25 is about 10 squared. That's about 100. Instead of looking for m around n to the 1/6, look for m around 100 n to the 1/6. And that, if you write n in base m, makes the leading coefficient smaller. It's easy to see it's about b to the minus 1.25 n to the 1/6. And then the other coefficients, it's hard to say how big they are. They're random-looking numbers as big as m, up to 100 n to the 1/6. Now, it would be nice if all those f's are about the same size as the leading coefficient, f5. If you write n in base m, then it has these random-looking coefficients, and you try varying m, and the coefficients bounce around, and occasionally they're all really small, like that 1370 example I had before. Maybe the five uncontrolled coefficients here, f4 through f0, are all much smaller. They're all b to the minus 1.5 times smaller than m. And if they are, and you plug that all into the mu value, then you see that you've reduced mu by a factor of b, which again is like chopping b cubed out of n. How often does that happen? How often are the f's, the coefficients of n in base m, each of these five coefficients b to the 1.5 times smaller than it would have been? Well, randomly, conjecturally, experimentally, happens about b to the 1.5 to the fifth, one out of every that many trials, one out of that many choices of m. That is about b to the 1.5 to the fifth, that's b to the 7.5 trials, until you find an m where the coefficients are all this small. That's what I said at the top, conjecture time, b to the 7.5 plus literal of 1, if you're spending, say, 10 to the 20 time on your factorization, then if you need time b to the 7.5 to handle a certain b, that tells you that b could be up to, say, 10 cubed, a little less than 10 cubed, which is not very big. But it's still better than not doing anything. Another technique, there's just a few more techniques, and then I'll have one slide finishing up, is instead of just controlling f5, instead of making m bigger, which forces f5 to be smaller, because n is about f5 m to the fifth, you can also make f4 be small. Because suppose you write n in base m. You have n as f5 m to the fifth plus etc. And suppose you shift m by some k, then you can choose k to make the next coefficient small. Let's see exactly how that works. If you choose k to be about f4 over 5f5, you write n in base m, and then shift to writing n in base m plus k, then, well, easy binomial coefficient calculation, you see that n is f5 m plus k to the fifth plus f4 minus 5k f5 times m plus k to the fourth plus etc. And okay, there might be some slop in lower order terms. This is, maybe you get a carry from the next term to this term, changing this by one or two. but it's going to be about right. If you write n in base m plus k, then the first coefficient is f5, and the next coefficient is f4 minus 5k of 5, and I chose k to make that small. Now, instead of writing n in base m, you write it in base m plus k, and if that doesn't work out, then we jump to another m. And this forces not just f5 to be small, but it forces f4 to be small. How big is f4 minus some appropriate multiple of f5? Well, it's at most about 5 times f5, if you choose k sensibly, or about 2.5 times f5 if you allow negative numbers. So you can force both f5 and f4 to be small by jumping from some m to some next m that is guaranteed by these simple equations to make the next coefficient small. You might be thinking, maybe we could control more coefficients. I'll get to that in a moment. This is quite a lot faster. It allows a much larger b than the b to the 7.5 before. If you look at a bunch of m's that are, I should have said, there's another trick that goes into this, namely increasing s. If you choose m to be about, say, 10 to the 8th times n to the 1/6, or choose m to be, in general, b times n to the 1/6, then f5 ends up being about b to the minus 5 times n to the 1/6. Again, you make m bigger, forces the leading coefficient of m in base m to be smaller. The random numbers f4 through f0, well, those could be anything up to m. And now apply the previous trick to make f4 be small. And then hope randomly, sometimes randomly, f3 will be, okay, how big is f3 here? This b to the minus 2 is not nearly as small as b to the minus 5. And f2 being b to the minus 0.5 times n to the 1/6, that's not nearly as small as f3. The polynomials that show up out of this method are kind of skewed, that f5 is really small, and f4 is also really small, and f3 is not nearly that small. F2 is not nearly as small as f3, and f1 and f0 haven't figured out anything about those. They're just as big as b times n to the 1/6. Remember the point of the f's. The whole point of this, playing these games with expansions of n in different bases, is we're trying to find small values of f5 I to the 5th plus da-da-da plus f0 times j to the 5th. And depending how big i's and j's are, you can make some of the f's be more or less important. And that's what the scaling factor does. If you have I being b to the 0.75 times bigger than something, and j being b to the 0.75 times smaller, then okay, a little bit of calculation, work out the exponents carefully, you see that mu has been reduced by a factor of b. The chance of this happening is 1 out of every b to the 4.5 choices of m. All right, the fanciest methods that we have do some lattice basis reduction, which in the remaining minus 1 minute, I really, really want to finish on time here. So in the remaining minus 1 minute, I'll say, okay, you can slightly control F3 using lattice basis reduction. If you didn't think lattice basis reduction was cool already last week, then here's another example of it. It shows up all over the place. And well, okay, you do a lot of work, and instead of b to the 7.5, you get down to b to the 3.5 with trying to make F3 be small. You can find, given an n, you can find an m such that when you expand n to base m, well, m plus k plus vl with appropriate k's and so on, you can expand n in some base so that the first coefficient is small and the second coefficient is small and the next one is also kind of small. And that's the best anybody knows how to do. All right, I have 2 slides left. Once you've looked at a bunch of m's and crudely estimated how good they are, then you'd like to say, okay, exactly what m are we going to use? And exactly what y are we going to use? What are the prime bounds going to be? And then what early abort parameters do you want to use? There's more parameters that you can choose in the number field set, which I'll just abbreviate by saying y. That's your critical parameter. Well, you could just try experiments with some m's that look good, for n is written as small polynomials in base m. And you could just try writing down some congruences for those m's and for different choices of y and see how likely those numbers are to be smooth. The problem is that to get a good estimate for a very rare event like smoothness by just trying it out probabilistically, you need to see it happen a bunch of times. If you are looking at some random event and you see it happen once, you have no idea how likely it is to happen. If you see it happen twice, then you start getting some more confidence. If you see it happen 10 times, then you have a pretty good idea of how frequently it happens. You need to see smooth congruences happen a fair number of times before you can be reasonably confident what the smoothness chance is. And that's something that takes a while, just because smooth congruences show up only 1 out of y of the time. It would be nice to have something faster, and we do have all sorts of faster things. And this is my last slide, is just summarizing the state of the art. I'm going to have slides online pretty soon, and then if you want to see all the remaining slides I have explaining some of these things, then you can, but okay, I will finish with this slide. You can, by some numerical analysis, writing down something called a superelliptic integral, which is connected to superelliptic curves, that's why it has that name, you can figure out how many small congruences there are. Remember, the point of selecting congruences is you want them to be as small as possible to have them be as smooth as possible. And in the context of the number field sieve, it's a little bit tricky to figure out how big the congruences are. But that's something you can do accurately, not just bounding. You can really get a feel for how big your I minus JM times I minus J alpha norm are. And you can figure out, this is something you heard about last week, so I don't feel bad skipping it, that you can figure out how likely your congruences are to be smooth using bounds on Dickman's function. That's not too accurate. You can use bounds on C, the Hildebrandt-Tenenbaum approximation. These are things you heard about last week? Well, okay, I hope you heard about these things. And also you can use power series approximations, and these things cover all the complications of number fields. You can get a very good idea of how likely numbers are to be smooth, much more efficiently than trying them out and seeing how often they're smooth. So putting that together, you can figure out how many smooth congruences you get looking at a bunch of small congruences. You can see how long is it going to take to guarantee a square, to find more smooth congruences than exponent vectors. Sorry, what I meant there is than length of your exponent vectors. Now, there's still one part of the number field sieve that we don't have a satisfactory analysis of. The only thing we know how to do is experiment, which is when you actually write down this many congruences, you see it's way too many. You could have gotten away with half, a tenth. There's lots of different parameter choices, and they give different ratios between how many congruences you need to guarantee a square, more than the exponent vector length, and how many are actually required. So it would be nice to have a fast way to figure out how these congruences combine, how many of these primes you really need to look at. And this is something where, well, there's a lot of experiments, and nobody really has a feeling for how that works. If, on the other hand, you just want to say, okay, we know that this is going to be good enough, this will make the number field sieve work in this amount of time, and maybe it will actually be twice as fast, but okay, this is a guarantee for at most how long it's going to take, then we have very good ways to figure out which m's will give the smallest time there to estimate how long the number field sieve will take. So if you have some cryptographic number to factor, which is chosen to be just beyond what you can factor, it's important to take all this into account. Thank you for your attention.